The subject was a self-evident, and I think that's the only introduction you need. The second part of this tape contains a lengthy postscript in which I give additional advice on the same subject.
All right. Okay. What we have is a situation where you're going to be contacting, what is this, a friend or a relative? I've forgotten.
Relative, brother-in-law.
Okay. A brother-in-law who is, by your own description, a good Jew, correct?
Yes.
Okay. He is a somewhat observant religious Jew. He is a good man. You described him in the off-tape conversation as a guy who's got, shall we say, natural virtues, and he's had a pretty rough life. He suffered a great deal, and he's been manly about it and steadfast and patient, correct?
Yes.
And what you said was that you don't want to face Judgment Day yourself without being able to give an account on why you never invited him into the Catholic Church, correct? And what you hoped was is, you called me with the idea of getting perhaps an approach, a suggestion, an attempt or a way to go to approach the apparently good religious Jew, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and what I made reference to is that when we're talking about a Jew here, we are not talking about the Jew in the proper sense of the racial concept, the descendants of Abraham and Isaac, and Sarah, but we're talking about the concept of a rabbinical Jew, one who holds primarily to the Jewish worship system and the Jewish ethical system, correct? Okay. Now, right, what I suggested was that if he is a conventional Jew, that the and that's how I'm referring to the man as a rabbinic Jew, is that in general their view is as follows: that when a man dies, he will be judged by God and will either be determined to be righteous or non-righteous. If he is righteous, then his righteousness will be counted in his favor, and he will share in eternal rewards of heaven. If he is not righteous, then he will be eternally punished. Now, the Jew tends to be very vague about this, but he does believe in an afterlife. He does believe in a reward. He does believe in punishment, and generally he lets that go, and that appears to be a very attractive situation. It's a conventionally type acceptable concept. The good are punished, the bad are not. Excuse me, the good are rewarded, the bad are punished. And what I was suggesting as the approach that one should take is that you should deal with the concept of what happens to the sort of in-between situation, and doesn't the all-or-nothing situation actually destroy the concept of good and evil? In other words, if two men were to die, let's make it extremely hypothetical, if two men were to die, say, in a train crash at exactly the same time, and one was, say, 70 years old, and one was, say, 40, and the 70-year-old man had led a very, very good life, say, from a Jewish point of view, and the 40-year-old man had led a not very good life, but good enough, then when they both die and are judged, they would both get into heaven. Well, what this is saying is that 70 years of an excellent life is equal to 40 years of a not-so-excellent life. Let's expand it slightly differently. If there is some black-and-white standard, some pass-fail system, which means that if you are above a certain passing grade, you automatically get into heaven, then all the evil things one does that don't disqualify you from this status are literally ignored by God. What this means is that the evil man does, as long as it doesn't disqualify him, does no harm. And this is literally an absurd thing, because that means that God does not care about evil, and God does not care about good, and God is not just or even merciful. Because if he were just, he will punish evil. If he were merciful, he will, when he should punish evil, forego the punishment. If, however, there is no punishment, and if there is no reward other than heaven, then what has happened is we have set up a situation in which God is literally indifferent to the values of good and evil. And I don't think any ethical rabbinic Jew can hold to this at all. To use a simple analogy, which I think would help. Obviously, men at any particular stage are alive or dead. And that's clear. We're either our body and soul are united or our body and soul are separated. Simple definition of life and death. However, at any particular time, we can be in various different grades of health. A truly healthy, strong, well-developed, well-conditioned athlete is quite different from a heavy smoker, drinker, person who's in the hospital nearly on his deathbed. They are both alive. But in one case, the man has spent his life conditioning his body, avoiding things that would be detrimental to him, and developing his physical abilities. In the other case, the fellow has abused his body, abused his health. They're still both alive. But obviously, from simply the health situation, we understand that the consequences, that there are consequences to activities which either increase health or lessen health. In the same sense, I think that you would accept that there are righteous things to do and not righteous things to do. Obviously, the Jew feels that he should go to, the observant Jew feels that he should go to temple on certain days, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, and on those days he should perform certain ritual behaviors. Now, if these things are good, even from a Jewish point of view, then they merit a reward from God. If the person is getting into heaven, then unless we argue that there's different stages of reward in heaven, and it's a totally separate issue, there is no reward for doing the good. In other words, if the righteous man obeys those parts of the Mosaic law that observant Jews obey, if he goes to temple, if he follows certain Jewish traditions and customs, and the other guy goes to temple only two or three times a year, doesn't pay too much attention to his fellow man, occasionally mentions that he's a Jew, and also gets into heaven, then we have a situation where the Jew is following laws, rules, regulations, which have no effect on his eternal judgment. And if they have no effect or affect on his eternal judgment, then by definition, God is indifferent to them. And if God is indifferent to them, then it can't be the right system. So the Jew is faced with this following problem. If one can get into heaven by being the good secular Jew, that is, following the standards of the world, in other words, being charitable, etc., being kind, being faithful to one's wife, these are certainly things which we Catholics advocate, but they're the things which the world even advocates. If that's all that's necessary, then what we have is a truly secular religion. And God is not the creator and the judge. He's sort of the clerk in the passport office who stamps your passport when you come into the country. He didn't give you the passport. He didn't give you permission to enter the country. He didn't fly the plane. He just witnesses the fact of what you've done. He's not a judge. He can't keep you out. And if that's what we're dealing with, then by definition, the Jewish religious system is no longer effective. Because the only reason that one has a religious system is to bring about, literally, salvation, which means to please God enough so that one will share with God eternal life. And the Jew is faced with this problem. Again, that the classic, or shall I say the contemporary Jewish position, is that not only the Jew, but the righteous Gentile will also be saved when it comes to judgment time. This, again, is a difficult premise to sustain, because if the Gentile can be saved without going to temple, without observing the holidays, without circumcision, without the prayers, without the law of Moses, then the law of Moses is not necessary. Now, the only counter-argument that the Jew might offer is that God has two salvations. The salvation of the Gentile, which the Jew doesn't comment on, and the salvation of the Jew, in which he is saying that having been a descendant of Abraham and Sarah, he is obligated to follow in the law given by God to the Jew. The problem with this is as follows. Number one, if the Jew holds that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc., and Noah, even as an example, or Adam, are saved, that if they are all in heaven, then they were not saved by the Mosaic Law, because the Mosaic Law was not in effect, because by definition, the Mosaic Law came into effect only with Moses. So, as a Jewish convert pointed out to me once, there were Jews before the Mosaic Law, and there will be Jews after the Mosaic Law, because it is a racial identity and not a religious one. So now we have, if the Jew wishes to argue that the Mosaic Law is necessary for salvation, we have the awkward situation of him explaining how Jews, because obviously Abraham being the first Jew, his descendants were, how Jacob, Isaac, etc., Joseph, those patriarchs could possibly have been saved if they didn't follow Mosaic Law. So Mosaic Law is not necessary for salvation in the old days. Also, not a single Jew in the world follows Mosaic Law today, because Mosaic Law consists of approximately, I forget the exact number, but I think it's 613 prohibitions and commandments. Contained in various different books in the Old Testament, Numbers, Deuteronomy, etc. No one, I emphasize this tremendously, no one fulfills this law. One of the Mosaic commandments is that disobedient sons are to be killed. Well, no Jew kills his son when his son is disobedient. Now, perhaps they did in Moses' time, but no one does it today. If the Jew goes around and simply, and this is what all observant Jews do, is that they simply follow some aspects of the Mosaic Law and ignore others, then what they have is quite literally a pick-and-choose system in which they're allowed to accept certain things, reject others. This is not Mosaic Law. To use a simple analogy, the traffic law says you stop at stop signs, you obey the speed limits, and you stop at red lights. If a person says that he is a perfectly legal driver, but he simply goes through all the red lights that he chooses to go through, because, well, that's there, but we don't pay any attention to it, then he's not a legal driver. He could even argue that he's a safe driver, that going through red lights under certain circumstances are not bad, and that would be fine, but he's not an observant driver. No Jew can say that he is observant. No Jew even advocates that Jews obey the Mosaic Law. So the argument that the Jew is saved through the Mosaic Law falls apart for two reasons. Number one, none of them obey it today. Whether any of them ever did or not is another question. Number two, they didn't obey it before it was established and given from God to Moses. So therefore, it is not the means of salvation. If it is not the means of salvation, we're back again on the concept of this proper concept of righteousness. But again, righteousness introduces this concept of a graduated scale of rewards and punishments. Is there only one reward, and is there only one punishment? If so, again, we have the problem that God is indifferent, utterly indifferent, to the smaller goods and the smaller evils. Certainly it is wrong to kill, such as in the case of an abortion. It is also wrong, of course, to get angry at someone and punch them in the nose. But they certainly, unjustifiably, they certainly aren't the same. If one goes to hell for punching one in the nose, then God would be saying that he thinks abortion is the equivalent of punching one in the nose, which, of course, is quite literally an utter absurdity. By the same token, it's a good thing to care for our fellow creatures. A person who stops in the roadway and sees an injured dog and takes the dog to a veterinarian has done a good thing. A person who spends his life doing this actually has done a good thing. But at the same time, he drives over human beings to get to the dog, well, then he hasn't done a good thing. But where in the Jewish system can one say that one good is better than another good? again, to argue that all you have to do is be righteous or good to be saved, all you have to do is be unrighteous or bad to be damned, is to say that God doesn't care about the everyday life and the everyday acts which make us human beings. And this, of course, goes totally against the Jewish tradition, which, you know, when God gave it to Moses and later as it grew into, was that every act, or almost every single act in life, can be done to the fulfillment of God's will for man. That the ritualistic behavior, the ritualistic acts, the ritualistic prayers, etc., can be done in accord with God's will. That's the Jewish tradition. From that it must follow that God has a plan by which man may live his life in accord with God's will, not just the big things, not just the murders and the massive acts of charity, the saving of one's life or the giving of one's life, but the minor things, the acts of patience, endurance, the smaller acts of charity, the smaller acts of forgiveness and tolerance. These things, of course, must have a value in God's system. By the same token, the small acts of cruelty, the smaller lies, the smaller acts of anger, the small, more minor acts of selfishness, these must also have a place in God's plan. Now, if we then argue, and I think that you would have to, that God is just, then justice means that each one of these acts must carry a reward and or a penalty. And the reward, of course, could be even the lessening of the penalty for an evil act. If God has no reward and penalty for these things, then he is not only indifferent, but he is quite literally unjust, which God cannot be. God must be just. Again, the Jewish Old Testament in the Psalms contains many references to mercy. O Lord, be merciful to us. O Lord, give us your mercy. This perfectly legitimate view, but mercy can only be exercised by a power and a judge who has the authority and the ability to inflict just punishment on someone. You cannot ask for mercy when you are not going to be punished. As an example, if a man were to be tried for a crime and to be acquitted of the crime, the judge would then say, okay, you're free to go. For the man to ask for mercy at this point would be an utter absurdity. We would think that he was insane or didn't understand what the verdict was. If God finds all of the righteous just and automatically rewards them with heaven, then the cry for mercy is nonsense, literally nonsense. And yet the Psalms are filled with it. The Psalms were written by King David, who the Bible describes as a man after God's heart. And if David was asking for mercy, and he was, then how could he be asking for mercy if he were going to be rewarded simply with heaven? It's an utter absurdity. But remember, these are the inspired words of God preserved in the holy book of the Bible. These cannot be absurdities. These cannot be stupidities. These cannot be things which cannot be reconciled. There must be a reason why the righteous man asks for mercy. The reason is that the righteous man, even though he is saved, still owes a penalty for the sins which he has been committed. Again, the old Jewish concept of the blood sacrifice of animals for the remission of sins was that based on the concept that sin needed to be paid for, that the remission of sin required some act by man on his part in appropriation to God, a payment for God, a compensation in a certain sense. That's what a sacrifice means, among other things, when it's offered for sin. If the sacrificial system were valid at any time, even only symbolically, when the temple existed, then how does the Jew do away with his sins today? If it were right then to make some kind of offering to God for in reparation for sins so that something worse wouldn't happen, it's still right today. If it were wrong then no man could be a Jew and he must leave his system. So in other words, if the Jewish system under the Mosaic law were ever correct, and of course it was correct, then the principle established then must be the same now. That sin requires some acts, some appropriation for it, some remission, some activity on man's part. Therefore, for the man to be a Jew, he must hold that he still must do something for this, which means that the current Jewish concept of the pass-fail system when you're judged, the righteousness versus the non-righteous, cannot be sustained from a Jewish point of view. Also, we spoke with this before we started the tape, was this gentleman that we're dealing with has suffered a great deal in his life, and apparently he's been quite patient and enduring on it, and God bless him for it. But now we bring up the whole concept of suffering, which has no place in a Jewish ethical system. If man is righteous and is going to go to heaven because he is righteous, then why would God inflict suffering on him? And when we say inflict, we mean even in the sense of allow it to happen. Even if one wishes to argue that, well, I lost my leg in an automobile accident, or these diseases simply happen, or I inherited from my parents, certainly good God who created Adam and Eve in the world and separated the Red Sea and stopped the sun for Joshua, this God could prevent illness, and this God certainly allows illness and accidents to occur. So we must say in a certain sense that at least indirectly, God is responsible for the sufferings of human beings. Well, we Catholics easily can explain this with the concept of purgatory, among other ways. But the simplest one is that the suffering we endure can be offered up as a sacrifice for our own sins or for the sins of others who are being purged in purgatory. What does the Jew offer in terms of suffering? If he is a righteous man by some Jewish ethical system, that is, if he is a somewhat observant Jew, if he is, according to the Jewish system, going to be rewarded with heaven when he dies, then why would God cause him to suffer now? Well, suffering is inflicted by a loving God or a loving parent on people for really only one or two reasons. One is as a purpose of discipline so that one may behave more correctly in the future, or as punishment for past sins or indiscretions. The parent certainly will tell his child, you did this wrong, I will punish you. And he will deny him some privilege or make him, if he breaks something, perhaps he'll make the child pay for it. By the same token, a parent may encourage a child to learn certain habits. In other words, like here, stay in your room and do your homework, and once your homework is done, you can watch TV or something like that. That's not a punishment, although for the child it may be a suffering. The parent is trying to teach the child a behavior pattern so that he can benefit from it in the future. Those are the only two reasons why anybody who loves another person will allow or inflict suffering. Since the Jew will accept, of course, as we do, that God loves us, and the Jew will accept, of course, as we do, that suffering at least comes from God in the sense that it is at least permitted by God, we now have the situation that one of those two explanations must exist why man suffers. That is why the righteous man suffers. The unrighteous man may very well suffer because God is punishing him. We can simply, from the point of view of the man is opposed to God, we could accept that, at least in theory. But the righteous man, the one who's going to go to heaven, the observant Jew, why does he suffer with disease? Why does he suffer with pain? Why does he suffer with anything? Well, if it is as reparation of his sins, then God is concerned about his sins, and the key question happens, what if the man has not suffered enough by the time he has died? What if by the time he has died, he has not fully paid for his sins? And for the person who would argue that you can't die before you do this, I would point out that you could very well die committing a sin. Governor Rockefeller, the former governor and vice president, died in an act of adultery. Well, he died committing a sin, and obviously he didn't make up for it before he died. If that sin puts him in hell, then that's one thing. But if he gets into heaven, if he is declared to be righteous, how could he make up for that sin? And if he doesn't make up for that sin, then God doesn't care about it. And once again, if God doesn't care about sin, then everybody gets to heaven, and God is indifferent to good and evil. And that is not any definition of God that anyone can accept. So if God makes man suffer because of past indiscretions, then we have the situation which ultimately leads to purgatory. Well, then man will suffer after he died if he hasn't fully paid the price. And the Jewish system of simply pass-fail, simply reward or punishment, heaven or hell, can't be. There must be something in between. By the same token, if God allows suffering on a person in order to bring him to a higher state, in order to improve him, in order to discipline him, the only reason he could be doing this is that this higher state is necessary for salvation, which means that once again, suffering is a part of salvation. It means that you have to go through something for salvation, which means that God has a standard, which is apparently just more than simple pass or fail. Because we look through life and see the righteous sometimes suffer, sometimes not. Well, if simply being righteous, simply being, say, an observant Jew within the Mosaic system or the semi-Mosaic system is enough, then why would two Jews both going to the temple have such different problems? The reason is because this is something more than the simple Mosaic system. And what I would suggest is, upon approaching someone with this, is that you approach them with the concept of, again, if the Mosaic law, the Mosaic law is not really in effect anymore, it isn't really working, and that the concept, the value, which is necessarily associated with God, of good and evil, good getting reward, evil getting punished, must still be in effect. Because the very nature of God and the very nature of man requires this. So, even if we go back to Genesis, just as an example, after Adam and Eve fell, God inflicted certain punishments upon them, that the women would bring forth their children in pain, and the man would have to earn his food by the sweat of his brow. But he also promised a Messiah. In other words, things will be bad, but there will be a solution. This is the basic Jewish message that was passed on to the basic Christian message. Things are bad, but there is a solution. You're suffering because of sin, but there is a way that the suffering will matter. And this is how I would approach the gentleman you're talking about. I would approach him with two concepts. One is this concept of right and wrong, not the massive right and wrongs, not the abortion and the genocidal acts, not the guy who lays down his life for his friends. No, the smaller good and evil, the punch in the nose and the dollar given to the beggar. If those things are not counted by God, if those things are not rewarded by God, if those things are not dealt with by God, then God doesn't care about good and evil. And God doesn't care about our daily lives. And God doesn't care about us becoming better or worse. And that's not the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, nor is it the God of Paul and Peter. It's not the God of anyone. It must be some Hindu God. So, again, take that approach of the smaller good and evils, how do they matter, and then try to tie that in with the concept of suffering, that if suffering is necessary in order to make a person better or in order to make a person less evil in the sense of pay for your sins, and that's the only explanation for suffering, then since man does suffer and since God does allow it, these truths, or one of those truths, definitely must be in effect. And the Jewish ethical system, the current rabbinic system, has no place for it. And if it has no place for it, then it can't be true any longer. Okay, what do you say?
Oh, I appreciate the time you spent with me.
Well, do you think it's worthwhile? I don't know.
Oh, indeed.
Okay.
Oh, sure. It's worthwhile. And you're going to send me a text.
Yeah, again, Mike, forgive me. I just want to make sure. I'm just going to turn the tape off.
This is, of course, side two of the tape, and we're dealing with the same subject. I would like to say that the first side was obviously a conversation, and I gave it pretty much extemporaneously. I would like to point out now that I believe I can add some postscript-type remarks, which I believe will help the person in this subject matter. That is, approaching the Jew with the effort of evangelism, conversion, etc. First of all, I would like to say that when you're dealing with the modern secular Jew, or even the modern so-called religious Jew, you are dealing primarily with a mindset, if I can use the word, a philosophy, even a culture, that is an accepted sequence and series and collections of values, customs, approaches, traditions, etc., but not really a religion. I think this is shown very clearly in the movie Fiddler on the Roof, in which the actual religious aspect of the Jewish life in Russia is very small, but as the opening song says, tradition, the way of doing things, the way of looking at things, is the primary determining factor for the Jew. And this is certainly the case also with the American Jew. I would like at this point to demonstrate the approach that I think you should take by telling a brief story. And interestingly enough, it describes an old TV commercial. The TV commercial had the late Sammy Davis Jr., who was a convert to some form of Judaism, presenting wine in glasses to some friends of his. He asked them what they thought of it, and they said it was very good. Then he produced the bottle, which had a towel wrapped around it, and then with a fanfare removed the towel and showed his guests that the wine was in fact Mogen David or Manischewitz, some significantly well-known brand of Jewish wine. The people were surprised because those who are not used to Jewish wines usually do not find them to be pleasing. So the point was that Sammy was trying to get across, and the commercial was trying to get across, was that you might very well like Jewish wine if you don't know it is Jewish wine, if it is not identified in advance. I think this is precisely the approach that you should take with the Jew. By no means should we deny Catholicism, by no means should we compromise the issues or the differences between us. But what I'm saying is, I think we should present Catholicism from a point of view of what it is, not what it is called. One of the problems with the American Jew, particularly, is that the American Jew is very frequently, if not always, an anti-Catholic bigot. Part of the mindset, part of the philosophy, part of the tradition he grows up in, is that the Catholic Church is his enemy. Christianity is his enemy, and of course, he sees Christianity, as all rational people do, as embodied in Catholicism. His tradition, his distorted view of history, points out that the Jew suffered significantly at the hands of Roman Catholic bishops, priests, lay people, popes, etc. This, of course, is completely and utterly wrong in the sense that not that Catholics haven't sometimes been unfair and have persecuted Jews. Of course they have. But, as I clearly demonstrate in the ARM tape, The Church and the Jews, the Catholic Church has been the greatest protector and friend of the Jews throughout their entire history. So, in fact, the truth is that the Church loves, in the true sense of the word, that means looks out for the benefit of the Jew, and this bigotry, this nonsense, these slanders, which are part of the Jewish mindset, are completely and utterly false. However, I do not suggest that you approach this subject directly. Don't avoid it if it comes up, but again, I would not suggest that you approach it directly. One of the problems is that you could get into an historical quagmire. By this I mean you'll be quoting sources, he'll be quoting sources, and you'll simply be getting into which encyclopedia is more verifiable. Once again, if you obtain the tape, The Church and the Jews, it has sources that are easily accessible and you can prove the case. If you get into that, obtain the tape, use it, and make the case. But in the meantime, I think you should avoid getting into the hair splitting that Jews tend to do and Jews tend to love. By this, again, as Jesus described them properly in his days, they swallow an entire camel but choke on a gnat. They very, very precise on very, very petty things while ignoring the overall view of life. That is why I suggest that the universalist approach be taken. By this I mean, in essence, and I hope I have demonstrated it somewhat or indicated what you should do on the other side of this tape, take those things which are common to all human beings. All human beings suffer. All human beings look for meaning in their life. All human beings value truth. All human beings value basic virtues, which have both natural and supernatural aspects. We all admire the just, the merciful, the charitable. We all admire the noble, the brave. We all admire he who endures, he who is temperate, he who is prudent. Again, these are supernatural virtues which are reflected in the naturally good nature of man. Again, simply going back to Genesis, which of course the Jew uses to form his mindset, man is created for a purpose. Man comes from God. Man has a goal in life. Man sins, the problem of sin. All of these issues are universal in the sense that all human beings deal with them ultimately in one way or another. They may turn to drugs, they may turn to Hinduism or some form of New Ageism, or they may turn, as the Jew frequently does, to ethical expressions of meaning in his everyday life. In other words, he does what is good rather than what is supernaturally good. By that I mean he does the naturally good thing rather than the supernaturally good thing. This is a starting point which I believe can be quite profitable. What defines good? How does one determine what is good? Does not God get involved in revealing these things to us? Again, understand that the mindset of the Jew, in so much as he honors the Bible at all, is that God has chosen men, certain men, given them certain truths, and then will judge them on account of them. I've made this point, I hope, clear on the other side of the tape. This is your starting point. And what I'm saying is that you should deal with this universalist concept. Number one, all men suffer. Number two, all men seek truth. Number three, all men seek meaning to life. Number four, all men seek a meaning and a value to their suffering. If you stay in a generalistic concept without using the word purgatory, without using the words remission for sin, if you take, in a certain sense, a philosophical, theological approach, if you delve with these issues and deal with them on a universalist, sweeping, generalistic type view, I hope and believe that you will be able to establish that the necessary characteristics of any religious system which is going to give meaning to life and be in accord with the God who created us all must be the religious system which explains sin, explains suffering, explains the meaning of man for life, explains the basic inherent value of man, and gives meaning to the search for truth and the apprehension of truth once it is identified. It must be a system that gives suffering a value in terms of love. Obviously, only Catholicism does this. Only Catholicism gives meaning to this. But stay away from the word Catholicism. Simply say things like, simply as an example, if God makes us suffer, that is in the sense of God allows us to suffer, and if God loves us, and if God has given us this inquiring mind, then somewhere there must be an answer. And the answer must be at least hinted or represented on this side of the grave. Otherwise, we suffer even in our seeking of truth on why suffering exists. And that is a good thing. And a God who makes us suffer for a good thing alone is a strange God, or is a God who inflicts suffering on us for a greater good. Either one of these approaches can certainly lead to Catholicism, where, of course, the suffering as the greater good could either be our unity in the sufferings of Christ, or again, simply purgatory. I would not bring the words up. I would simply say that the system, the true religion, must have some explanation for this, must give the answer to the meaning of life, must give a direction and an intermediate goal for man's search for meaning. That term, man's search for meaning, comes from a book written by a Jew who was, I believe, a psychiatrist named Viktor Frankl. Dr. Frankl was a survivor of one of the concentration camps. And one of the points he makes at the end of his book is that if a gorilla or an ape were being injected with a disease so that he would develop the disease, so that the humans could study the procedure of the disease, the sequence of the disease, the progress of the disease, so that they could then develop a cure, so that humans would not suffer from this disease. If this occurred, Dr. Frankl asks, is there any way that man could convey to the ape, to the monkey, why the monkey is suffering? Frankl, of course, points out that there is no way to convey this information to the ape. There is a gap between us which cannot be bridged. He then says, in essence, that perhaps this is the way God deals with us. There is a gap between us which cannot be bridged. Well, the problem is, of course, that the ape doesn't ask in advance why he's suffering, what would be the value. He doesn't ask his trainer for anything other than food and shelter and perhaps affection. That's the nature of an ape. We are, as it says in Genesis clearly, created in the image and likeness of God. We have part of God within us. God has breathed into us. So therefore, the inquiring nature of man's mind is quite different from the lack of inquiring nature of the ape mind. God created us clearly with the intention, the goal, the nature of inquiring after the meaning of life, the nature of suffering, the nature of truth, the value of truth, the value of suffering, etc. Since God created us this way, and since God loves us, he understood this, and he understood that we would seek these major answers to the basic questions of life. To say that God was incapable of creating a way or bridging the gap so that man would understand what God intends is to say that God is limited in his power. And of course, this is something which I think anyone defining God correctly could not accept. So therefore, the approach to the Jew on this should be dealing with the basic identification of the necessary attributes of God: omnipotence, all-powerful, all-knowing, and loving, and then noticing the frustration of man if he does not achieve a way of understanding what life is all about. If this is not to be satisfied while living, then life is truly a curse and not a gift. And the Jewish ethical system, the Jewish tradition, is that life, of course, is always a gift, regardless of how much suffering there is to it. These are, again, our suggestions towards a generalistic approach. I would like at this point to point out something which I believe you should definitely not bring up. I repeat, not bring up.
I also make this as clear as possible. This is my own personal view, and therefore you may accept or reject it. You may choose to follow my advice or choose to reject my advice as you see fit. The thing I suggest you do not bring up is the point that Jesus is, in fact, the awaited Messiah of the Jewish people. One of the problems here is that the concept of a Messiah in contemporary Judaism is vague at best, and because this is or has been a very touchy issue among Jews of different sects and subdivisions, there is sometimes a gentlemanly understanding that this subject will not be brought up, and therefore it is considered bad manners to bring it up. That is one reason why you should not do it. It would simply create unnecessary offense. The second point is that most Jews, I believe, have been trained or conditioned to respond in certain ways when dealing with the Messiah. In other words, they have been conditioned to see things in such a sectarian way that the presentation of new truth is not going to change their minds. You're simply going to run into a preconditioned ideological cant. You'll run into almost a reflex reaction by certain words on certain concepts. By the same token, many secular Jews, and by secular Jews I mean essentially the rabbinic Jews, have been conditioned to put the Messiah concept away, out of their minds. It is something that is no longer central. Getting on with the everyday existence, the everyday life, the everyday living, the keeping alive of Jewish traditions, the acting in a Jewish fashion, the ritualistic behaviors of Judaism, these have come much to the prominence. And again, the religious aspects, of which the Messiah concept is certainly central, have taken a secondary place. So therefore, what you are doing is bringing up something which they have become in many ways religiously indifferent to. It is simply not a subject they are prepared to discuss, a subject they like to discuss, or a subject they are willing to discuss. If you bring this up, you are again likely to run into either a stone wall, a vigorous counterattack, or complete indifference. In any case, those three responses are not very productive to the overall goal, which is bringing the Jew closer to true Christianity and Catholicism, his true home. This does not mean to say, of course, that we are denying that Jesus is in fact the Messiah for the chosen people. Of course he is. What I am simply saying at this point is that by establishing the system, taking a systems approach, establishing the value of Catholicism to the Jew where he is today, if one can establish that, if one can establish the Catholic Church as the new Israel, establish the Catholic people as the new chosen people, then it will follow automatically that Jesus is in fact the Messiah. What I am saying in this case is to take a, shall we say, secondary approach or a path of least resistance on trying to get this key point across. Once again, I clearly point out that this is my own personal view. You may choose to accept it or reject it depending on the individual personal circumstances you come across. And at this point, I would simply point out that there is a tape available from Arm called The New Chosen People, in which some of the arguments are advanced on why Catholics are now the new Jews, the new chosen people. And that brings up an interesting point. The concept of the Jew, that is the descendant of Abraham and Sarah, is that he is God's chosen people, or part of God's chosen people. And, of course, God cannot go back on his covenant, his agreement with his chosen people. He cannot go against that. The Jew, of course, feels, rightly so, that he still has a special place in creation. If he does have a special place in creation, and of course he does, then one of the approaches you might use is, why has God apparently forsaken the Jew? There is no more temple, there is no recent Moses, there are no prophets universally accepted. The Jew, although he may now have a homeland in Israel, it is not the way it was. It is not the paradise on earth, not that it ever was, but it is not truly the religious state in the sense that it ever was. There is no temple. The Mosaic Law, again, as I pointed out on the other side of this tape, is not the law of the land. So if God is still concerned with the chosen people, and he is, then God will provide a way by which these chosen people may still approach him in the spirit of truth. Since he does, and since he must, then this approach, this way, this institution must be somewhere. Another point which you may, well, from that must be somewhere, you're simply trying to establish the identity of the institution. By this I mean, once it is conceded that an institution exists, or a way exists, or a religious system exists, which is true, then it will follow that it only is a matter of identification, and then you could point out that the proper characteristics of this institution are answering the major questions of life, suffering, truth, value, meaning, ultimate goals, salvation, etc. I would also point out at this point that you could bring up other aspects of Judaism and Catholicism that are similar, but I'm not particularly sure if similarity will help a great deal. Sometimes this will give the false impression that Judaism and Christianity are actually variations of the same thing. And again, I repeat, by Judaism, I mean the contemporary Jewish traditions which are under the rabbinic system today. The system is not a valid system. It will not provide salvation. It is not a reflection of the covenant between God and man. It is a false system. It is the vestiges, in a certain sense, the remains, the ruins, if you wish, of what once was perfectly valid and what once was the true way for a man to approach God. However, it has been replaced. And the fact that Judaism no longer has the vitality, no longer has the life, the power to satisfy that it did, as reflected in the Old Testament history, is an argument that one could use. But one should be careful about that. One must understand that when dealing with the Jew, he is conditioned by his mindset to see all forms of criticism, and certainly what we are offering as criticism, as anti-Semitism, as he defines it. Anti-Semitism, as he defines it, is the rejection of a Jew or a Jewish custom or a Jewish ritual or a Jewish institution simply because it is Jewish out of hatred. Now, in a certain sense, this is not what we're doing, but it is what we will be appear to him to be doing if you make it a Catholic versus Jew issue. We are not rejecting any Jewish institution or value out of hatred. We are rejecting Jewish, things that are particularly Jewish as opposed to things that are Jewish and also true or also Catholic. We are rejecting things that are particularly Jewish because they are wrong, because they are invalid, because they are ineffective. So in the same sense, we reject Jewish religious values in the same sense that we reject Protestant religious values and Buddhist and Mohammedan religious values. They are true only in so much and to the degree that they agree with us. But if you identify this as a Catholic versus Jew issue, it is very likely that you are likely to arouse the emotional anti-Semitism, which unfortunately has become part of the mindset and personality of almost every 20th century Jew. It is not the time or the place to explain or justify this paranoia which seems to infect these people. Perhaps it is in a certain sense justified, because certainly there have been acts of anti-Semitism which have led to large-scale persecutions of Jews simply because they were Jews. But, again, we must be clear in our own hearts that this is not anti-Semitism in that sense. It is not anti-Judaism in that sense. It is simply the advancement of truth. And when truth is advanced, when Catholicism is advanced, everything either conforms to it or is rejected as false. That is the attitude you must have, but it need not be expressed in exactly that way. Once again, to attempt to summarize what I am saying and what I am suggesting, that you do not deal with the Messiah issue, because I think it will be unprofitable, but approach the Messiah issue indirectly by dealing with those things which the speculative Jew, the philosophical Jew, and I think that describes most of them, are interested in. Why does man suffer? What is the meaning of truth? What is the meaning of life? What has God in store for me? Why am I here? Those speculative philosophical issues can be easily turned into massive, gross, universalist theological issues. Then, when the necessary characteristics of what must be true are identified, then gradually the towel can be slowly pulled off the bottle and can be shown that the true wine, the true fruit of the vine, exists only in the Catholic Church. Thanks for listening. God bless. Additional copies of this tape or any of the tapes mentioned in this tape as references may be obtained by contacting us at ARM, it's the All Roads Ministry, 55 Palin, that's P as in Papacy, A-L-E-N, Road, number 38, Hopewell Junction, New York, 12533. Hopewell is one word. Thank you for listening. God bless.